It's not even ability to change, it's even ability to recognize that the things are changing. That's what ruins leaders, when they become blindsided by the things around them.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is how to avoid the biggest innovation mistakes and where AI fits in. Pharma have always relied on medical innovation to bring the next big drug to market. Now, we have a lot of factors showing us that medical innovation alone is not enough in pharma. And a lot of these changes have been brought on by AI. Earlier diagnosis means our patient populations are shrinking. Precision medicine means that we are shrinking our target populations. And we've got DTX and so many more areas that are meaning that we really need to innovate urgently. So how can pharma successfully innovate throughout their organization successfully? My guest today is Bruno Pesic, who's a highly respected corporate innovation expert. So good to have you on the show, Bruno. Such a topic so close to my heart right now.
So happy to be here.
Good. Can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you ended up in this space?
Yes, happy to. And I'll keep this brief. I actually started as engineer, and I started by learning how to design aeroplanes and aerospaces, etc. And during my studies, I was fascinated by something called industrial engineering. And that is basically how do people interact in big systems to make wonderful things come to life. And that somehow led me to, you know, start my career in defense, working as design engineer, working on very, very difficult and challenging projects. And I had very early on a big project that failed. We did a perfect thing. So the customer asked us for the impossible. We made it, and then nobody believed it was possible, so we couldn't sell it.
Oh.
Wow. And to me, that was a trigger, like innovation, like you mentioned for pharma. It's not just about medical innovation. That was my moment where I realized, okay, innovation isn't just about the perfect product. And somehow one thing led to the other. I ended up traveling the world, working with large companies in different industries, from financial services, med tech, entertainment, education, oil and gas, etc., helping companies become more innovative. And it's a different journey for every company. But that's, in a nutshell, my journey.
Very interesting. I mean, I'm also very interested in aerospace. I'm also a pilot, by the way. I'm a pilot of airplanes and helicopters, but very interested in that area. But I agree, you know, medical innovation is what pharma have survived on. And if you look at other industries, all of them have something like that. If you think about cars, it was, you know, engineering breakthroughs in cars. And yet Tesla comes along and innovates in a completely different way and wipes the floor, basically. So it's really not just about that really cool innovation that these companies have relied on for decades. So one of the things that I read you talking about was distinguishing between doing and managing innovation. Could you tell a little bit more about the why and the how behind that idea?
Absolutely, absolutely. Would love to. And it is connected to what you earlier started talking about. So yes, every industry has been known for a very specific either product, and then their innovations will be based on improving that product and eventually ecosystem around it. So that was from the car industry to pharma, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Why to distinguish between doing and managing innovation? A lot of companies that are product-led are very good at what I call doing innovation. That is taking an idea and then bringing it to life, either to incrementally improve on their existing product portfolio or maybe add something that they haven't had before.
Yeah,
that is not an issue today. We have a lot of models. We have a lot of expertise on how to bring ideas to life. What is an issue, especially when it comes to creating the future of an industry that's being disrupted, is capability to manage innovation. What I mean by that is doing innovation at scale. So how do you develop 100 ideas at different time scales that are not copycats or, let's say, self-cannibalizing of your existing product portfolio. Because if you just keep incrementally improving your existing product portfolio, you might be doing well today, you might be doing well in 10 years, but you will not be more resilient to disruption like we had recently with COVID, war now in Europe, changes in supply chains, changes in customer habits and demands. You know, you do not become more resilient to such shifts in the space if you, I use air quotation marks, just keep incrementally improving your existing product portfolio.
Exactly. And
taking management approach to innovation has a lot to do with actually managing risk. Mm-hmm. Because we started immediately talking about innovation, and I forgot to say the thing about innovation that's actually very important. And that is, it's one of those words that if you ask 10 people, you're going to get 20 definitions.
Yeah.
And what's important is that in your organization, everybody has the same definition.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be my definition, doesn't have to be Andres' definition, but in your company, everybody should have the same definition. So here in this context, when I'm answering your questions, Andre, I'm thinking about innovation as something new that creates value, not new to the history of mankind, new to the organization and new to the customers, and valuable both to the customers and to the organization. So that is, in a nutshell, what I mean by innovation in that space.
And what would you say are some of the biggest mistakes that you've seen in innovation?
Oh, there's a lot, but let's pick three that are my favorites. So one is forgetting to capture the learnings. And this is especially prevalent in R&D heavy and knowledge heavy industries, where the learning is captured in the experts. So you have your PhDs, you have highly specialized professionals. They dedicate their whole lives, their whole careers to moving forward a specific niche or part of the industry. Mm. If you're a 1,000-person, 10,000-person, or 100,000-person company, you cannot claim that expertise if it's only with Bruno or Andre. Because if something happens to us, the company loses that whole expertise. So actually doing a lot of, let's say, risky innovation projects, if you're not documenting all the learning, you're wasting away huge amount of potential. Because even if you have an idea that, for example, let's say you're developing the drug that ultimately you decide to discard.
Mm-hmm.
But if in the process you learn something about the process of drug development, how people reacted, how did your people come together to do something that's a little bit different, all of those elements can be reused, let's say, for another project.
Yeah.
So you get to create value even though the ultimately product did not land in the market.
Yeah.
The second big mistake, and that is unfortunately very prevalent in larger organizations, and that is choosing to invest in orphan ideas. An orphan idea is something that somehow ended up on your innovation pipeline, or like, hey, let's develop this. But who proposed that? Whose is this? Who's going to bring this to life? Bruno? Andre? Somebody else? Oh, let's find some people and assign them to this idea. Here is the thing with innovation, especially if you're talking about something radical, transformative, something that will challenge the status quo. It's difficult.
Mm.
And it's difficult on the people running that project. So you absolutely need someone who is passionate and has heart for that specific idea. It's almost impossible to do that with orphan ideas, because it's nobody wants them. They're rejected. Nobody claimed ownership on them. Yes, you could assign people and tell them, now it's your job to develop this. But, you know, when the going gets tough, it's much more likely that it's going to turn into a zombie project that people aren't going to move forward, because it requires willpower and grit.
Yeah.
So it's better to avoid orphan ideas.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you've said that executives fear innovation. Can you elaborate on that concept?
Yeah. So every innovative idea is uncertain by default. Otherwise, it would be, how could it be innovation? If we knew everything, then we just go and we deliver. We know all the things. Innovation isn't like that. It is very, very possible to do everything right. What I mean by everything right, you know, get the right people, have a very good idea, experiment with it, run trials, etc. And at the end of the day, we still decide, hey, this is not the product for our portfolio. Customers aren't reacting well. Let's sunset it. It's still possible. And if you look at every executive, I mean, they're measured on their performance. And now put yourselves in their shoes. You have a limited budget. You want to assign it to create the most performance possible. And it's always competing. Like, hey, you have these ideas that are risky. You could not only lose resources, but reputation and standing amongst your peers. So all of that seeps in, and then they go for safer options. What is possible also is to look at from the other side and think about, okay, how can we counteract that? What can we offer to these executives? Well, one thing is always to focus on the opportunities that have very sizable upside. And this is, again, something that's silly, but it's often overlooked. When we talk about ideas, it's not the same if you're, for example, a startup or a scale-up in pharma, or if you're an incumbent. So for a scale-up, maybe capturing $100 million annual recurring revenue is very good. But for incumbent, it might not even be a blimp on their P&L because they're operating in billions of dollars. So it's very important to actually be aware of the scale. And you do not need to run 3 to 6 month market research project to understand that. You can quickly scope any market just with a back of the napkin calculation. Of course, you will not make a business case out of it, but just to get the feeling. Because guess what? Humans, especially experts, are good enough at estimating when using ranges. So if I try to guess how tall are you, if I just say one number, I'm almost 100% wrong. But if I try to state the range, you know, you're tall between this and that, I'm much more likely to be somewhere in the correct range. Yeah. And the same is with estimating the upside. Like, I don't need to know how many people exactly would pay for the drug, how much exactly would they pay for the drug, etc. But to just do a quick estimate, I could put, you know, between that and that percentage of population, because we know that that and that percentage of population is suffering from specific ailments. And if we have, for example, this and this type of revenue stream with this and this type of cost or price, bam, we have a range. If that theoretical range isn't even enough or attractive to our company, hey, we do not need to set up a team or invest even $1 million dollars to start exploring this opportunity. When it comes to innovation, as I said, final outcome is uncertain, which means that revenue, profits, etc. are uncertain from the outset. Mm-hmm. What is certain and what you have absolute control of are costs, the inputs. What people do you put on? What's the time budget they have available? What are the resources, materials, etc. they have available? Now, blockbuster superstar projects usually get superstar budgets. That's horrible. That's executives' way to ruin their reputation. What's much better is to create, let's say, a war chest or a budget specifically for innovative ideas, but release it in tranches. Mm. Like, you know, if you have treats for your dog, you do not feed the whole box of treats to the dog. You give him 1, 2, 3. I realize I'm not saying treat your people like dogs. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, as executive, as a leader, you're much, much better by releasing funding in tranches, in limited amounts, and you fund specific learning goals. Yeah. There's something in finance world called real options theory. To really, really make it simple, in essence, by making small investments, you have an option to stop early. That protects you from burning too much cash. So imagine you have a budget of 200 million. So instead of assigning that to superstar team, you give them, hey, you need, I don't know, 10 million to run first trials, to test out some assumptions, some hypotheses. This is what you have. When you bring back the learning, we will decide if we release the next tranche. That might be a little bit higher. In doing so, you encourage the team to move really fast with the things that matter the most. You save your own cost and you maximize potential returns down the line.
Yeah.
These are some of the things executives can do to not fear innovation so much.
Can you share some of the key takeaways from your book, Augmented Strategy, as well?
Okay, no problem. So key, absolute key number one is that in today's world, if we want to make best possible decisions, we must combine data with human intuition, absolutely, not one or the other. So if you remember, like, just look 20, 30 years past, there was almost fetishization of let's suppress human. Let's suppress what you think and be completely 100% objective just based on the data we collect. That doesn't exist. Data is dead. It is humans who interpret that mm-hmm. data to make sense out of it so we can create a better world. People talk about intuition, gut feeling, especially, for example, women's intuition, etc., like it's some sort of witchcraft or black magic. The thing is, what people call gut feeling is actually our embodied bodily response that maybe our brain cognitively still hasn't processed, but it's basically accumulation of our lived experience with what we are seeing, hearing, saying, etc. So what we are advocating is more critical approach to kind of embracing, hey, listen to yourself, consider the data, combine that to make the best possible decision today, because the world can change overnight, like it did.
Yes, that's such an interesting, I was having this discussion with someone quite recently about that intuition concept, because, you know, the human brain is amazing, and we actually can do a lot of the sort of tasks that AI can do, but we're not aware that we can do them. And I kind of feel like, you know, given that the majority of the time we're using less than 10% of our brain, probably intuition is, you know, actually connecting the dots on so many different things, but we're just not aware of what those dots are. And our brain has kind of processed it in the background. It's quite an interesting topic, which we may do another podcast on that alone. So what can leaders do to thrive in a world of disruptors, fast movers, and copycats?
Okay. It's a big question. And I'm just going to give some high-level tips, especially today. Everything is moving so fast. There's plenty of reports, data analysis showing that the length, or let's say lifetime, of a successful organization is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. I'm actually advocating for going back to the basics and really, really, really mastering them. So if we take an average company and ask people, okay, why do you exist? What do you do? I'm not talking here about kind of, you know, high level passion statement that you print on your posters, etc. But, you know, what business are you in? What are you trying to get done? Mm-hmm. Okay, who are actually your customers? What are they trying to get done? How do you help them? So kind of really, really focusing on those basic primordial needs. You know, when we start looking into kind of financial services, like what are banks in the business of? Well, they're in the business of providing capital to individuals to fulfill their dreams and satisfy their needs. That is kind of high-level abstraction. But if you start going down, then we can go into mortgages, we can go into specific types of loans, we can go into specific type of insurances, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But being specific around that, because if you're able to dig into what are your end users actually trying to get done, those little jobs are much more stable over time than things that are fads that come and go. And if you're able to identify that, which company usually was able to do so many, many years ago, but loses it over decades, then you're able to adjust when difficult things appear, when shifts in behaviors appear, etc. Yeah. Because you go back and you're able, okay, this is the basic need they're trying to meet. If we need to change our product portfolio, we are going to do so. But unfortunately, what happens is a company becomes very successful with a very specific type of a business model. Like, for example, in pharma, most of the successful companies have actually the same business model.
Yeah, it
may be different products, but the same business model.
Yeah.
And then you forget how did that business model come to be. And when things around you start changing and shaping, you're set in your ways and you... It's not even ability to change. It's even ability to recognize that the things are changing, because you become blind to it.
Yeah.
And that's what ruins leaders, when they become blindsided by the things around them. I've seen it, and I'm sure you have seen it.
I'm seeing it right now. Yeah.
Yeah. The dominant approach of incumbents was basically to lock themselves in their walled castles, put their hand in the sand, and basically have, you know, we have a lot of money on our accounts, we have a lot of resources, we have a reputation, we're just going to weather the storm.
Yeah.
Well, to those people, I just asked them, do you know why castles weren't used after a few centuries of warfare? Because people figured out that it's possible just to march around them. So, yeah. That's what made castles obsolete.
Exactly. And I see this happening in pharma right now, because we've got so many challenges, as I mentioned, which are all, maybe not all, but a lot of them are from some of advances in AI. And so, but we've also got things like value pricing, which means, you know, it's the value that is being given by the medicine. And, you know, this whole paper pill model is such a castle, you know, to use your analogy. And we really need to change the model, because the whole environment has changed so dramatically, but we're still, as pharma, in these walled castles and still trying. You know, I see a lot of innovation theater in pharma, you know, so hackathons and all these kind of things, which make it look like there's innovation, but actually it's just theater. So how do companies get off that innovation theater treadmill into real innovation?
Mm-mm. By connecting all their innovation efforts to their strategy and goals. And yes. Here I'm talking about real strategy and goals. And you yes. mentioned hackathons, yes. ideathons, yeah. all yeah. of those classic
innovation theater. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Those events by themselves, you know, they can be useful, but they must be connected to a specific objective or strategy or whatever you're doing in your company. And yeah. let me share you what's the worst thing you can do when you run such an event. Collect ideas and never get back to any of your employees.
Yeah, yeah.
that will kill innovation culture in your company overnight, just like that, so yeah. easy. People don't care if you reject their ideas. People care to hear back from you. Like yeah. even if you say polite, you know, thank you, no, because A, B, whatever, doesn't have to be like one page response, just a yeah. polite response, they yeah. will respect that. But if they never hear, not only will they not contribute again, they will tell to all their colleagues while having lunch, breakfast, whatever, they're going to tell them when a new event comes, they can, it's not worth doing, like, I know. I was there last time, never heard from anyone.
Yeah. Bam,
kill it just like that.
Yeah.
If you want to move away from the innovation theater, the best thing is to be very, very specific how innovation has to contribute in your company.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that, as I said, by innovation, people mean a lot of different things. It's much, much better to be very specific in the means, I don't know, we want to increase our profit margin by 10%, and we expect innovation projects to contribute to that. Oh, yeah. now we have a little box where we will actually prioritize profit generating and higher margin innovations
yeah.
compared, for example, to continuous improvement type of incremental small innovations, etc. Everything is important, but you as a company, you prioritize what has to happen. So it's yeah. incumbent upon you to present this frame to other employees, peers, etc. And that helps a lot in you know, moving away from innovation theater to actually innovating for real.
Yeah. And where does AI fit into all of this innovation?
Yeah, it's a huge topic. We are seeing AI developing, at least publicly. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not an AI expert. I'm aware of it. But what I see now happening around is the face side. I'm sure much more has been happening in the background with people who are actually developing such models.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm seeing the biggest use, and I'm seeing that both with my clients and people in my environment, there's a lot of generative AI used to create simple prototypes that help the brainstorming process and innovation process, not as end product, but to create something tangible to discuss much, yeah. much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
To be fair, those were mostly images, videos, etc. So not text generation, like, for example, ChatGPT. ChatGPT, most of the use cases I've been seeing is about summarizing long documents and then preparing summaries.
Yeah.
It is a bit tricky because it is still black box. So
yeah. and it still makes things up. It hallucinates.
Yes. Yeah. So at least I see much more use currently in terms of visual and audio-visual AI generation methods to help speed up and reduce the cost of ideation processes. Mm-hmm. So kind of you have this is, oh, how could this look? You give a few prompts, then you have this array. It helps a lot kind of because our brain can discuss something that's tangible in front of us. And it also helps to discuss things, let's say, more roughly. Because I want to be gentle with Andre, and I hope you are gentle with me. But if you're discussing ideas, I want us to go hard on that idea, you know, to be able to rip it apart, to rip it to shreds.
Absolutely.
And it's much easier, you know, if we can quickly generate some outputs, put them in front of us. Okay, that's A, that's B, that's C. Let's go ham on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about the risks? What do you see as the biggest risks to companies when they're implementing innovation? You mentioned that in one of our earlier points.
Yeah. There are many risks. But if we focus on several types of risk, let me... we have the risks of developing any idea. So taking from idea to a business, that's one set of risks. You will usually hear about desirability. Will customers want it? Feasibility. Can we do it? Viability. Can we financially make it? That's one set of risks that's often talked about all over the space. The other set of risks that isn't that often talked about, and this is what you asked me early on about doing and managing innovation, are the risks associated with managing innovation. And that's, for example, the risk of opportunity cost. If we had options A, B, C, and D, how much does it cost to take option D over option A? If option A would have actually generated much more revenue, profits, whatever positive outcomes compared to option D, even if option D generates some positive outcomes, the difference is an opportunity cost. Unfortunately, we do not have crystal balls. We cannot tell the future, but it is something to be aware of. And that's why it's so important to have this metered funding, to release it in tranches. Because if I have my best employees, my most brilliant minds working on, for example, drug A, and then something B comes along that turns out to be much more interesting, lucrative, beneficial, etc., I want to be able to move my superstars from project A to project B, not because project A is failing, but because project B could bring in so much more, both to my customers and to me. So I want to minimize this risk of opportunity loss. And that is something that is challenging to quantify because it depends so much on what might happen in the future. Yeah. And it's also difficult for people to wrap their head around because it's so abstract. In essence, it doesn't exist. You will become aware of it only in the future, and you do not want to dwell too much on it because it can ruin your self-confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess for mitigating the risks, you know, not doing everything in one big bang, but, you know, drip feeding the war chest, basically, into different areas.
Absolutely. Drip feeding and always listening, like always monitoring what's happening.
Yeah.
You need to have feedback loops. So people think, especially in leadership, we're going to set strategy and then our people are going to implement it. The thing is, a strategy is a set of assumptions, a set of informed guesses. Those informed guesses are tested in the real world. Leaders must be fed feedback back to them, just like R&D innovation people always listen to what customers have to say so they can tweak their ideas. Leadership must listen what market is saying so they can tweak their strategies so they can assign resources better. It's never set in stone, especially not today.
Absolutely. I had a really interesting discussion about 2 or 3 years ago with a professor of strategy from Harvard University, and we were actually looking at how we could, and it's possible, it would cost a lot, but it's possible. Actually, when you look at what people use, the data people use for strategy, you know, and it's data that they will take one snapshot in time and come up with the strategy and job done kind of till the next year. But actually, there's so much data there that you could devise AI to be constantly honing your strategy and comparing, okay, what's the latest data upload from today for yesterday that's actually has a meaning that could impact that our strategy is not as effective and we need to pivot slightly with our strategy. So it would be really, I'd really like to do that. Why do large companies rarely see returns on their innovation?
Okay, so for all the reasons we have discussed so far, among other things, but one of the main drivers is that companies often see innovation as a one-time thing, one-off deal. I like to compare it like to physical exercise. You cannot wake up one day and decide, I want to go to the gym and I want to lift, I don't know, 300 pounds. It's impossible unless you're already big, strong, and you can do it. But if you're not, you need to go to the gym regularly. You need to exercise. You need to do all the different exercises. Your muscles need to grow, recover, etc. And then you will be able to lift it. The same thing is happening with companies. Even if they see big opportunity, if they haven't developed their innovation muscles, they're just going to see it pass by them, even if they have the intention, even if they have the resources, because they do not have the capabilities. Mm. So either they will be forced to invest a lot, which will then diminish the returns or make them negative, or they will try and fail and then say, this isn't for us. So that's why it's important to continuously develop your innovation muscles by doing a lot of small projects, those incremental innovations, adjacency innovations, etc. Because then you will have the mindset and systems and capabilities and people that can jump on a big opportunity that comes by and that you can actually profit from. Yeah. Because, I mean, what good is an opportunity if it bankrupts your company?
Yeah,
it's not a lot of good.
And speaking of that, how do you measure innovation in a meaningful way without stifling the creativity and tripping on bureaucracy?
Okay. Another big topic. I'm just going to give some highlights and tips to the listeners. And okay, when we talk about measuring innovation, a lot of people actually talk about just measuring product performance. So you will hear a lot of advice, you know, measure the funnel, you know, measure how you get customers, how you acquire, how you activate them, how do you retain them, how do you get them to refer, how do you collect revenue. All of these are important measures. But I say those are just one family of measures to measure the product metrics. Now, what you need to measure are two other parts that aren't that much discussed. So one is metrics for the innovation process, and another one are metrics for your innovation strategy or portfolio.
Yeah.
I'm just going to give you examples. These are not the only metrics. These aren't the metrics that you should just go copy-paste and say, hey, it's working for us. It is much more delicate. Every company needs to figure out the best metrics for them. But when you're trying to establish metrics for measuring the innovation process, you want to be looking at speed of learning and quality of learning. Why? Because in initial stages, sometimes possibly 3 to 5 years, truly radical innovations might not be bringing in any revenue whatsoever. Mm-hmm. What the team is going to be doing is they're going to be experimenting a lot, testing their assumptions a lot, evaluating their hypothesis, etc. So you want to basically keep on track on that and understand, okay, are they learning quick enough? What's the cost of their learning? Remember what we discussed, you can control inputs, not outputs. What is the quality of their learning? Because big assumption we are making is if they're learning fast, cheaply, and it's good learning, that's a leading indicator that their idea will ultimately be interesting and could ultimately generate good profits. So you have these leading indicators for financial lagging indicators.
Yeah.
Now, some metrics for measuring the innovation strategy or innovation portfolio is looking at, for example, the distribution of all your innovative ideas. Okay, how many of those are kind of extending the core? You know, if we are producing this type of drug, how many of them is basically improvements on our existing drugs or kind of some small supplements?
Yeah.
That's one. Okay, what are we doing in the space? Are we doing anything adjacent? What's the percentage of that? And finally, what are we doing that's, you know, completely novel to us? Like, we haven't done this type of drug or for this type of ailment, disease, etc., for this type of end user. That's radical. So you want to have all three. What ratio completely depends on your risk appetite. Some people will say that there are hard rules. I say, no, there aren't. You're in command of your risk appetite, but you have to be in command. It shouldn't happen by accident because, you know, one leader decided to have that and another leader decided to have that. And then you're like, woo, How did that happen? So in addition to risk to portfolio distribution, you also want, for example, to be monitoring a new product vitality index. How much of new revenue has been generated by products launched in the last 3 to 5 years?
Yeah.
Continuing to that, you also want to be monitoring, for example, the average difference in margins between innovative ideas and old ideas. Margins are often overlooked when analyzing innovations. In my opinion, innovation is about value creation. Mm-hmm. If you're also having an approach that commensurate value returns back to you, that means that your innovative ideas on average should have higher margin than your existing product and service portfolio. So these are just some ideas for your listeners to think about at these different levels. There's much more. If you look up innovation accounting or innovation accounting book or head to my website, you're going to find a lot of these metrics. And I always preface, use them as inspiration, not to take them copy paste and then start measuring that.
Yeah,
it's not a good change management process.
What lessons could we extrapolate from all of your experience in the other sectors into the pharma sector?
Business model innovation. So you're already experts in your product innovation, in your medical-driven innovation. Do not relinquish that. Now start focusing and looking really hard on business model innovation. That means innovating with how you communicate with customers, what kind of relationship you have with your customers, what type of revenue models you have with your customers. So completely focus on their side and see everything that doesn't have to do with your core product, because all of that represents an opportunity to create new value for your end users and customers, economic buyers, but also for you. To give you just a small brief example from completely different industry, Rolls-Royce and their turbines, their old business model was making them and selling them.
I use that model a lot, actually, because it's very relevant to pharma, isn't it? Because they've switched. They were sell a car and now they're subscription as well based on usage. And I think there's a lot of parallels, even though maybe people don't like to hear it. I think there's a lot of parallels in the pharma and what they were doing and how they switched. And there's so many lessons that we can learn from the Rolls-Royce model for sure.
Absolutely. So kind of switching around from transactions to more of leasing, licensing, different type of relationship, because that introduces a completely new set of family of services and et cetera.
And their revenue has been higher than it's been in the history of their lifetime since they changed their business model. I mean, it's been very successful. So So just finally, you've written a practical guide to lean experimentation. Could you just share some of the highlights from that?
Absolutely. We spoke a lot about, in the last half an hour, about experimenting, testing assumptions, testing hypotheses, etc. And I'm sure in pharma, you're following very rigid, very scientific, very objective approach to it, many steps. Here we are talking more about business experimentation. So think about it that you take those principles, but you relax them a little bit because it's imperfect. You will never have a lab. You will never have perfect conditions. So in that approach, what we call lean experimentation, the key goal number one is to start with, okay, what are we trying to learn? And then break it down into assumptions to be researched, hypotheses to be tested, and then figuring out what's the quickest way to learn that. And finally, what we discussed earlier, remember about capturing the knowledge and insight. So once you did that, data, insights, decisions taken. Your listeners can find the full guide, everything completely free on my website, and I'll share with you links, etc. It is something that, you know, I decided to share everything I know because I was fortunate as a kid growing up to have parents support me in whatever I wanted to study. And I had good mentors throughout my life and everybody was generous with me. So I just said, you know, whatever I know, I will be sharing it. It's application. It's not what you say. So
I'm really fascinated by this area. I've just written on LinkedIn a prescription for success, which goes, it's very long, 30 minutes to read it. So it's a weekend, a holiday read. I really explored lots of different business models and Rolls-Royce was one of many that I was looking at and drawing parallels to the pharma. Could you maybe just give us a list of your books that people can, or maybe your website so people can see what you've written and they can delve deeper into what you're doing?
Absolutely. So www.pesec.no. When you open it, you will see a resources tab, and there you can find a lot of things that Andre has asked me about. It's there. So the ebooks, the small books, the big books, the free stuff, Q&A, templates, everything is there. And if you have any question, you can reach out to Andre or myself. I will help if I can. As I said, I made everything publicly available. Use it to be more successful. I'd be very happy.
Thank you so much for your time today. I have really enjoyed this because this is such an important area for my industry, for pharma, but also just in general. I mean, all companies, you know, there's so many thousands of examples of companies like, you know, Blockbuster or Barnes & Noble, and there's so many companies that and Kodak, you know, because they didn't innovate and they kept thinking they were in their own castle and they were fine, they kind of failed. So we need to learn from them and you. And really change how we're doing things in pharma for sure. So really appreciate it. And I think we could have easily filled another 2 or 3 podcasts on this topic, and maybe we will. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.